Okay, I got invited back. So I guess it bombed too bad the first time. let's pray. Father, thank you for this church. Thank you that we can gather. Thank you that we're a family in you. I pray that that my testimony this morning, that what you've done in my life, might have an impact on anyone here for the better. That we don't boast in what we've done, but we boast in what you've done through us and in us. And so this morning is my opportunity to do that, to boast about you. So I thank you for that, Father. In your name, amen. So Jane and I, we kept rolling the dice this week. One of us was going to talk, and we, different circumstances in each of our lives, it's like, no, okay, actually I'm busy, you gotta do it. And then, no, this happened, you got, so anyway, so we're back to me. So I said, okay, well, this is a great chance to share my testimony. I haven't done that here at this church. And then I hope I've got a little bit of a message, you know, that maybe is helpful to some degree through this. But I want to start off with this passage. And this is Paul talking, and if you know anything about Paul, he was on quite the pilgrimage, going around from city to city, proclaiming the gospel. And actually, he was before that, he was persecuting all the Christians. He was going around trying to gather them all up, put them in prison. He was trying to silence the gospel. And he, at one point, I don't know where he was. Was he in the desert? God shows up to him. Jesus shows up to him, and says, "Why are you persecuting me?" And he blinds Paul, and then Paul ends up going. He says, you know, go to the city. There's going to be someone there waiting for you. And then he talks to one of his other apostles who comes and finds Paul. And Paul, was it Ananias? Is that who found? Someone reminded me. Okay. Ananias comes and talks to Paul. Paul gets his sight back. Paul encounters Jesus. Paul, like, his life just goes from black to white, just totally transformed. And he goes from with eagerness pursuing Christians to silence them, to with eagerness going and pursuing to deliver the gospel. And he was significantly persecuted. So he goes from being the persecutor to being persecuted. And this is what he says while he's in prison because of delivering the gospel. He says, "I rejoice greatly in the Lord that at last you renewed your concern for me." He's talking to a church that had sent favor for him. "Indeed, you were concerned, but you had no opportunity to show it. I'm not saying this because I am in need, for I've learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want, because I can do all this through him who gives me strength." And so there's a theme in my testimony that we'll come back to this, that I feel that I can resonate with this a little bit, especially in this last season, this last 5-10 years of my life. Anyways, so maybe I'm hitting the down arrow. Nope, thanks. Okay, there I am. Pilgrim's Progress, as I title this. I don't know if you know the book of Pilgrim's Progress. I've been reading the kids' version to my daughters. It's about our faith journey, and it's kind of a fictional narrative that does a really good job of it, so you haven't read it. It's sort of like the Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings of the Christian circle, you know, like the, kind of, it's, a lot of people read it, it's good. Anyways, I found this picture because here I am with a plane ticket, and it's hard to see. It says, "Credit Scott Simpson," a friend of mine, lives in town, you might know their family, but he gave me, I don't know if he won it on a radio show or something, he won a airline ticket for Pacific Coastal Airlines that you could use for whatever their destinations. He just gave it to me, which was so kind, because he, at the time, his health wasn't good enough to travel, and it was worth a few $100s. It was super significant for me. This was in my university days where I didn't have any money, and anyways, it was just a a real gift. And I'm starting this out because I'm going to tell you about my little pilgrim's progress and about my journey. And this ticket, we don't buy our own ticket. God gives us the ticket. You know, like, so Scott gave me the ticket for my journey. God gives us the ticket. The Spirit of God has made me, and the breath of the Almighty gives me life. He's given us this life. He's given us this journey, this pilgrim's journey that we get to go on. And it's supposed to be a gift. You know, it's got a lot of hard things in it. But he walks with us, and there's a gift in that. So this is my life. I gave it a little chapter. So chapter one, okay, of my life. A big miracle for a little guy. Okay, so my pilgrim's progress started. Well, first of all, before this miracle, I grew up in a Christian home. In particular, my dad was a strong Christian. My mom came from she was a preacher's daughter in the Baptist church, really conservative at the time, and she is your typical preacher's daughter, where she, like, the church just, it felt like a weight on her. Her dad's ministry felt like a weight on her. She had to push the church away because it didn't represent the freedom that God has for her. It represented suppression. My dad, he was different. He came to Christ. He came to Christ through my mom's dad, actually, the preacher, which is kind of funny. And he experienced that freedom. So, you know, my mom's been on a faith journey ever since, and kind of undoing all those lies that that have been implanted on her from her upbringing. But anyway, so my dad was a real influence in terms of telling me about Christ, about the freedom we have in him, about the truths that we have in him, the promises we have in him. So I knew these things in my head, but it hadn't gone, you know, I don't know, I was seven at this time when this miracle happened. I don't know at what point, to what depth it went into my heart, but this miracle sure increased that depth. So my dad, we lived out of town. My dad liked to buy old used, like, he wanted to give us every opportunity, but we didn't have the money for new things, you know, like, it's just we had old stuff, like, things that would break down, things that didn't work, but he got me this little ATV, a little quad, a little 50cc quad, and so I'm 7 years old, and I'm so excited to go ride this quad. It's like, you know, he brought it home. It was seven at night, and my mom, she was tight on bedtime. Nope, seven, bedtime. We're not riding that thing tonight, tomorrow morning. So sure enough, I'm up at dawn and getting my dad up. I want to ride this thing. And he lets me hop on there with, you know, my enthusiasm, and it being five in the morning or whatever, probably, you know, distracted him from giving me all the instructions that maybe I needed, not having ridden one of these before. So I hop on this thing, I'm ripping around, and we have a little hill with a bank beside our house, and I decided I'm going to go up this hill and turn around and come down the hill, but I got caught at the top of the hill trying to turn around, but then I was kind of sideways on the hill. So I knew enough, just because, you know, I had a bike, so I knew how to ride a bike, that, you know, when you're going sideways like this, you need to turn down the hill. So I turned down the hill, but it was premature because I hadn't got far enough yet to evade the bank at the bottom of the hill. So I'm going down. It was just a little bank. It was maybe on this high. It looked like a bigger bank for me at the point. So I nosedive off this bank, and I didn't brace myself enough, and I hit my stomach into the handlebars really hard. And now, generally, as a parent, I know that when my kids get hurt, and like I taught young kids for a while too, you know, my first reaction is all, okay, just wait for what kind of cry this is, right? Like, often, 90% of the time, it's fine. But this was like one of those situations where it wasn't fine. Like, I was really in pain, and so my parents are gauging, okay, what's going on? And I'm telling the parents, I have to go to the hospital, I have to go to the hospital. Now, you put so much weight on that when a seven-year-old tells you that in the moment, but anyways, they brought me to the hospital. And sure enough, I'd ruptured my spleen. Now, I don't know to what degree. It obviously, they didn't fly me to, like, Vancouver right away or anything like that, but, like, I had internal bleeding. And they said, okay, well, we don't have the surgeon in-house in Nelson. We're sending you to Trail. So they sent me to Trail. And they had done ultrasounds in Nelson when this happened, so to verify that, okay, so I had some internal bleeding going on. So they sent me to Trail. And the plan was they're going to do surgery and remove my spleen, because I think in general they don't heal on their own, and, you know, so whatever, that's what they had to do. I'm in trail, I'm on the list to get surgery, and as things happen in hospitals with people coming in with greater priority than you have, you get pushed down the line, right? So it's like now I was there for 2 nights and I'm just on IV, and my dad, I had a choice between my mom or my dad to stay with me. Now I knew my mom was livid at my dad for letting me ride this ATV and like getting her on the first day. So I decided it was safer to have my dad stay with me than my mom. So my dad stayed with me overnight for those 2 nights while I was there. So it wasn't the first night. The first night, I remember we got to watch all these movies that I wasn't allowed to watch, like Star Wars and stuff. And, you know, so I remember watching all these cool movies, Blade Runner. And then the next night is the night before I'm scheduled for surgery. My dad, now I don't know if this was out of fear of my mom or out of real concern for me or a combination, but if he were here today, he'd tell you that night, while I was sleeping, he prayed over me with a prayer with, is fervency a right word? With like a fervent prayer, with fervency, like to a degree that he hadn't prayed before. Like he sort of, you know, whether it was out of guilt that I, you know, it's his fault or whatever, he's like, but he prayed with fervency, like he wanted me to be healed. He prayed healing over me, that I'd be walking out of that hospital. And so I'm oblivious to this. The next morning I wake up, they're starting to strap me up for, like, putting my little head thing on and my gown and all stuff, strap me up for surgery. And they're starting to roll my bed out, and they roll my bed into the ultrasound room first, because they're going to redo the ultrasounds to make sure they know exactly where I'm bleeding, where they're going to do whatever they're going to do. So the nurse starts doing her ultrasound, and she's looking around, and she's, like, looking confused, and she goes out of the room and gets my file from Nelson where I got ultrasounds 2 days prior, and she's looking at them and looking at the thing and, like, do I have the right spot? Do I have the right file? And she can't find anything. So she's like, okay, I need to go get somebody else. So she goes and gets another nurse. They come in, they're looking. They're both, like, looking at each other. Like, okay, so they go get another nurse, their head nurse. They come in, okay, so they go get a doctor. They get another doctor. By the end, I don't know how many people are in there, but there's all these people looking at this ultrasound, and they're all scratching their heads, and they're like, this doesn't make sense. Like, 2 days ago, we got bleeding spleen. Now we got nothing. We have no sign of what's going on, right? And so they just told my dad. They said, I guess you can go home. And he's like, what do you mean? And they're like, and the person that was talking to him said, you know, I've seen some of these things kind of happen here before the hospital, where we have this unexplainable healing, miracle thing that happens, and we can't explain it, and it's just like, and we send you home. But you know, if he has any complications or anything, you know, come back right away. But at this point, you know, like, maybe take her easy for a couple of weeks, and we think he's okay. And I was. Yeah. You know, that, as a 7-year-old, that just went, like, from here to here, just, like, it, my pilgrim's progress just changed, right? Like, and I've held on to that even as an adult, you know, just, like that God did that for me, you know? And it wasn't even just the spleen thing. It was just that he showed himself to me. He showed how real he is. And it was something that I could anchor on in my faith walk going from that point forward. Like, when I had doubt, I could go back to that. And we see that. We see Jesus, that was his mission. He comes and he just, what'd he do first? Whenever he entered a city, he'd heal people. He'd heal the sick. He'd do miracles. And he would say it, he'd say it outwardly. He'd say, I'm doing these signs so that you'll believe. Because the belief is the true miracle. That's the true gift he gives you. Like, the physical is temporal. You know, we have an everlasting life. That is the gift he's got to give us. So, you know, by the way, if you haven't seen a miracle and haven't experienced one, Jesus also at one point says, you know, like, to those who've seen signs and believe, you know, they get credit. But to those who haven't seen the signs and yet still believe, he raises that even above. He puts faith on this level that's even beyond what you've seen and what you've experienced. So if you're in a faith walk and you haven't had a miracle, that doesn't mean that God isn't real and he's not doing something in your life. In fact, he's gonna reward even more for that faith. And remember, faith comes from him. It's not something that we even drum up ourselves. It comes from hearing the word of God. It comes from he's the perfecter of our faith, the author and perfecter of our faith. We need God in everything. Like, we need God to start the faith journey. We need God to go through the faith journey. We need him to end the journey. Okay, so my faith walk started with a little miracle. A big miracle. Little guy, a big miracle. Okay, so now I'm a little guy with big dreams. At 7 years old, I don't know if this was before or after the spleen incident, I saw a movie called The Big Green. Some of you might know what I'm talking about. It's this really B movie, not a good movie, but it's, I was so inspired. It's about this woman who takes over a class of kind of relegate kids, and she doesn't know what to do with them. She's a teacher. She's kind of a new teacher. They don't want to do anything, but then she shows them a soccer ball, and then all of a sudden she starts showing them all these little things, and they're getting better in these drills, and they're on the ground and doing headbutts to each other. And like, oh, anyways, they become this team that ends up winning this game, and they're all excited, and there's just this big inspiration that happens in their life. Okay, well, I saw this movie, and I was just absolutely inspired. I am going to be a soccer player, I said, right? I'm 7 years old, and I'm outside in our yard, and I'm doing the same thing. I got my brother probably throwing the ball for me so I can headbutt it back to him, and I'm doing all the drills that I saw in this movie. Okay, well, this took up a big, the first half of my life was about soccer. And, you know, I don't know if there's anything wrong with that. I think God, he works with us. Like, we have these passions and desires. And some people can put, like, an evil twist on, you know, anything outside of, you know, like, I wasn't the youth group kid. I wasn't going to Sunday youth group and youth camp every Sunday. I was going to soccer tournaments and, you know, I feel like God used this soccer journey in my life to teach me a ton of things. It's whether or not God's first in your life as you pursue whatever you're pursuing. And if God's first in your life, there's going to be life in whatever you're doing. If God's not first in your life and you have this idol that's before God, there's going to be death in whatever you're doing. It's going to bring destruction in your life. It's going to bring you away from him. So my dad, again, I think he helped me keep God first. But anyways, I was just passionate. I wanted to be a soccer player. That was a big thing. And I dropped out of school in middle school so that I could do school by correspondence. So I could do school half the day and then do soccer drills on my own the other half of the day. My mom was taking me. I'd really support parents, by the way. So, you know, if you're not in the same boat, like I'm the minority that way. I get that. But my mom drove me to Kelowna every week for a year and a half. She'd pick me up like at noon from, this was before I dropped out of public school. She'd pick me up at noon at school. We'd drive to Kelowna. I'd have an hour and a half soccer practice. We'd get a hotel room or stay with friends and then drive back the next morning. She'd drop me back off at school at noon. And they wanted to give me the opportunity to pursue whatever I was pursuing, to work hard. And they saw that, you know, if you're working hard, we'll support it. I was okay at soccer. I wasn't becoming at that stage of life. I wasn't becoming a pro. I had this thing, the thorn in my side, perfectionism. And I was unable to really reach my potential because of my own fears around failing my own expectation of myself. Like actually realizing, like trying my, if I were to really try my best and then fail and not get to where I'd hoped to get, it was like, that would be the ultimate gloom of like not reaching my own expectation of what I think I'm going to be able to do. And so as a teenager, it's interesting going through the ups and downs of pursuing this whole soccer dream and how I knew deep down I wasn't getting there. And yet, I had this narrative in my head that I was there, or I was going to get there. And so, anyways, I'm going to come back to that because that had implication in all areas of my life. But soccer was the area in my life that was highlighted at the time, and so I was seeing that happen. Okay, so I did eventually go to university. I had this perfectionism thing going on in school, too. Actually, my parents, when I was in grade 9, after this 2 years of doing this school by correspondence, so I could do soccer, I was starting to get lonely, and I had no friends, and I was, you know, just doing all my own things. So My parents decided, okay, we'll put you back in school. We tried a different school. We tried to go, instead of going back to Trafalgar, I went to Waldorf. And Waldorf is a really artsy school, and this whole idea of perfectionism, like I was all about, I had this A-type personality. I need to get straight A's. I need to do this. I need to, right? And you go to Waldorf, and there's no grades. And you do an art project, and they don't grade you. And there's no way to to achieve the expectation in your mind of you being a straight A student. Like, how do you know? So I only lasted 2 weeks there. They sent me home. My mom took me out of school, like put me back in, you know, my safe little box of doing school by correspondence, where I do a quiz and then I pass and I go to the next one, right? Because I got shingles. I was so stressed out from doing art. So this perfectionism thing really was like, it was deeply rooted in me. And it wasn't something my parents put on me either. It was just like, I was hardwired like that. My mom's hardwired like that too. Anyways, so I go to university, and I am not, I'm your kid who's not like, I can't wait to flee the nest and get out. I'm your kid that's like, I don't know if I'm ready to get out of the nest, right? Like, I wanted my mom still. I wanted, you know, like there's a big bad world out there. So anyways, I go to university. I really got a nice transition to university life. I went to Victoria UVic. Because I got to live with another family whose kids we grew up with here in Nelson, so like it was a nice little soft exit. But I'm just crazy stressed, because now I'm in university, and I'm used to being able to achieve all my own expectations of who I am. I'm able to achieve these straight A's. I'm able to, you know, I try out for the university soccer team, and that was my dream. Like, that from 7 years old, right, this whole thing was building up. I want to be on the university soccer team. And by God's grace, and I don't think I deserved it, I made the team. Because I was such a little loudmouth, telling everyone else what to do for some reason, because I had all this confidence for some reason, because I'd been coaching a lot of soccer. So I had this, like, I had this coaching kind of thing. So he kind of, I think, just got a little bit deceived, like I kind of knew what I was talking about, and yet I don't, anyways, so I made the team. So I played soccer that year, super high stress. I just constantly am just under stress, because again, this whole perfectionism thing, not like wanting to be a certain, meet a certain expectation, not being able to just enjoy the ride, enjoy the learning process, but wanting to be there now, be who I had planned to be since I was 7. And same thing in school. I decided to leave school, and I'm going to be a doctor, because that's the A-type personality thing to do. I'm going to go to university, I'm going to go in all the sciences. So I'm like in all the hard science courses, I'm doing soccer, I'm out of my comfort zone, I'm not living at home anymore. I'm on MSN. MSN was like the, you know, some of you maybe know what that was, like the Facebook, like it's like the FaceTime thing of the time. And I'm FaceTiming with my mom, and I'm crying at night, you know, like I'm supposed to be this university athlete, and like here I am crying to my mom at night talking about, I don't know, all my stress. The next year, I'm supposed to go back to school. Now, I really want to go play soccer again, because I want the prestige and the dream to be accomplished, that I want to be on the soccer team, the university soccer team. But I really don't want to go back to school and do all those science courses again and be living in that stress, combined with the stress of trying to meet my own expectations of soccer. Anyways, I go to tryouts, and I get cut. I guess the coach realized it from the year prior. Like, okay, this guy's like, okay, he might be, he got me once, he's not giving me a second time. And you know, it's, I kind of hold, you know, I should claim this as some credit, because it's not very often that guys make the team and then get cut the next year. Usually, you know, it's like a growth process. Like, okay, now we've invested you in a year. We're like moving you up the bench so that, you know, we've got you as a fifth year player and you're going to be carrying us on to whatever we're doing as a team. So not a lot of guys get cut. So I, on year two, this was a blessing in disguise. It was like this, I was super disappointed that I wasn't going to play soccer, but it was this weight off my shoulders, because it was out of my control now. I couldn't be the thing, like I didn't have control anymore being that thing that I was wanting to be. And I called home, and everything that was that straight, that A-type personality said, I need to achieve, I need to succeed, I can't take a break. Call home, and I'm like, I think I'm quitting school, I'm coming home. That was probably the first time that I'd done that in my, you know, late teens life, where I just quit something and said, I've had enough, I'm going to take a break. And that was one of the best decisions of my, you know, early years, early adulthood life, was just taking a break. So that was a huge blessing in disguise. So I go home, and long story short, I just had a year of rest. I had a Sabbath year, and it was wonderful. I just got to put all those things on hold, but I still had my dream. So I'm still, like, next summer comes around, tryouts for the soccer team are in August. I've decided I'm going to go back and change my school thing, so I feel like I got that figured out. I'm going to go back into teaching instead of doing the doctor thing, and so that'll maybe relieve my stress. I can just really focus on the soccer. So I'm chasing my dreams once again. Another blessing in disguise. It's late July. I'm in Kimberley for an adult soccer tournament, men's tournament, that I'm trying to get ready for tryouts again and try to prove to the coach that he was wrong and that I'm right. And it's the middle of the game. I get the ball. I turn to go towards their net. And I see on my peripheral a guy coming in this way really fast. And I think, okay, I'm gonna trick him. I'm going to flick the ball over his leg as he comes in to try to tackle me. I'm going to run past him. So I did that, flick it over him, and the ball is so in the air. So he's coming to me like this. He, when he sees the ball get up in the air, he raises his leg up in the air trying to catch it. And he didn't. The ball kept going. And in the meantime, I'm running this way with my leg planted like this, and his foot is right against my knee like that with a straight leg, and we're both running, you know, towards each other. And I don't know, yeah, I didn't feel much at the time, but I'm jumping over his leg to try to evade his leg to run after the ball, and I plant with the other leg to keep running. And as this leg comes forward to keep running after the ball, in my peripheral vision, I see my foot come up and almost hit my hip. And as I did that, I think I screamed, and I caught my leg that's now up here, and I dove to the side and held my leg in my hand. And I was in some distress. And I still can play soccer, yeah. Yeah. The ambulances that summer are on strike, so everything's a little delayed. So the game is canceled. I'm in the middle of the field, like right at the center of the field, so there's no way they can really play around me, you know, the game's over. And the whole team's all these soccer moms are, so we're all in our early 20s, but all of our moms still wanted to come to our soccer games, which was fantastic. So they're still there, and they've got like spray bottles and umbrellas, and they're misting me, and it's the middle of summer, it's hot, and they've got the umbrella to keep me cool, and shock has kicked in now, so I'm actually quite comfortable. And the teams are having a bit of a battle between the guy that did this. It was totally an accident. Like, he did not intend to do this. He didn't ever get a chance to apologize or anything because he was so shunned from our team. Like, I felt terrible for the guy. So hopefully he got the message at some point. Like, it was an accident. Things happen, right? And it was another blessing in disguise. So, you know, it'd be nice for me to share what's going to happen after this with him one day. But anyways, half an hour goes by, the ambulance shows up, they come, and now, again, a little A-type personality, like, I don't do drugs, I don't drink, they're like, you know, we're going to give you this mask with this medication, and laugh gas or whatever, nitrous oxide, so that we can, I don't do drugs, I told you, like, I don't know what I had in my, like, they're like, okay, well, look, we'll put this bottle beside you, and you can hold this mask, and if you have a change of heart, just put that on there and start sucking back on that thing, right? Because they're like, what we're going to do is we're going to put a strap around your ankle, and we have to pull, because when your bones break, your muscle seizes, and it pulls everything together. They're like, we got to pull it apart, because otherwise the jagged ends of the bone are just going to, they're going to do more damage. So they're like, we're going to strap this thing, and they literally have a crank, and they have to crank your leg, and then they put you on the board, and then they tie you down. And as soon as he said that, I was kind of looking open-eyed at him, and I had the mask kind of like ready, and sure enough, as soon as he started cranking, it was like, right? And that stuff is amazing stuff. Let me tell you, like that, you don't feel anything. So now I'm being rolled off on a stretcher, and I'm waving at people. I got my mask, you know, happy to. And so I go to the hospital. I broke my leg. Okay, another blessing in disguise. I was supposed to go back to school, and I've got this, like, I'm going to be a soccer player thing still going on. And you can imagine that from my perspective, which may have been a perspective where things are slightly out of balance in my life, that this could have been absolutely devastating. Like, my hopes and dreams are literally from 7 years old to now, like, in my early 20s, like, there's a lot of investment there, and they're gone. And something happened to me in the hospital that's inexplicable. I had a joy, and it was just a joy that came from inside, a joy that I knew pretty early on was from God, a miraculous divine joy that just sustained me through the whole thing. Like, I did not go down into what I thought would probably happen, like into this devastating, depressive type state. I was lifted up. I was just like, I have this joy. I don't even know where it's coming from. I don't even know what to base on. I have joy. And I just had great people around me too, supporting me and friends. And it was like, I look back on that period of life, like it took 2 years to recover from that fully. And I just have this joy theme all the way through that period. And it's just amazing to me. I'm amazed by it because that was devastating. So anyways, so here we go, blessing in disguise, because now I go back to university. And I was planning going back to university, going to trials, being a soccer star. It's not happening. Instead, I'm crutching to school. And I'm crutching to, now remember I told you that I was that kid that wasn't the youth group kid. I wasn't going to Sunday youth group every, you know, doing the Bible camp stuff. I'm crutching to the campus youth, like the young adults campus ministry thing, like the youth ministry. And I start meeting people there. And there was a guy on my soccer team who became a Christian, and we ended up living together. And then, but all these people start surrounding me, and like through this ministry and their friends and stuff. And we all ended up living together. And then a bunch of us, like our house became the hub where we'd all gather. We'd have 20 people over, like every night for that whole year. We'd do dinners together. I just had this fellowship that I never had. Now, I had it with my dad. I had it with, you know, but I never had this peer influence fellowship. And I just had this year, and then onwards, the next 4 years of university, a fellowship that I'd never experienced before. And it was like these are like my spiritual teens, what maybe would have happened if I was that youth group kid and not so focused on soccer. And there was just this growth in my faith in this season of life, like where all of a sudden I'm putting God's word into me, whereas before I knew the basics. I knew God healed me from my spleen. I knew he loved me. I had a relationship with him. I would pray and talk to him, but like I prayed often to him about soccer, right? Like now it's like, you know, like we're like going from milk to meat. We're like, we're maturing. And what a blessing in my life. And I still got to play soccer. Like 2 years later, I'm fully recovered and I'm playing soccer in Victoria. And I played actually at the highest level and my best soccer I'd ever played, playing with all the guys that were at that university level, but playing in the men's league. Like Victoria has a big soccer scene. I still got to fulfill those desires within me and have that while I was there. So now I'm worried. I want to come back to Nelson. So I grew up in Nelson. I want to come back here. I finished my teaching degree, so instead of doing the doctor thing, I became a teacher. I'm really hoping that I'm going to find a job in Nelson. At the time, it was hard to find full-time work as a teacher. Now it's not so much, but at that season, like the waiting list was huge. It seemed unrealistic to be able to choose where you want to be, but my family was here. That was super important to me. I wanted to be here. God gave me a job. Kara and Michael Presley, they go to our church here. You might know Kara. Kara was the principal of the Nelson Christian School at the time, and she hired me on a gut feeling. I had my schooling was for high school math and PE. She needed a kindergarten teacher. She looked at me, she's like, I'm not so much worried about what you can teach or can't teach. I want to know about your relationship with God. That was pretty much her only prerequisite. Like, you can, you know, you got your teaching degree. Okay, that check, box. Okay, now, what's your faith like? And she got the feeling that I was sincere. And I was. I'd just come from a real season of, like, being poured into. And so she hired me. So I have a class, it wasn't a big class, it felt like a huge class, but just six girls. And that was an extremely challenging endeavor for me. But I survived the year. But that year was just, okay, God gave me a job. He gave me fellowship. I started coming back to this church. I went to this church when I was younger. I was coming back to this church. I'm starting to connect with people I hadn't connected with before. He gave me fellowship, and he gave me, like, I was so becoming in love with having the word and just, like, studying the Bible and discussing this with my friends. I was like, I don't have that at home. I didn't grow up with those friends. All my friends were into soccer, right? I come here, Lyle, I connect with Lyle, and we start doing his men's group Thursday nights at his place, and I just connect with all these, and we are going deep, and we're going deeper than I've gone before, and we're going more into the spiritual stuff. I've done more of the theological stuff. I'm starting to understand, starting to hear about the spiritual world and what's going on there, and so I got exposed to all that. Anyways, this was just like, so I'm calling this like batched it in the Garden of Eden. It felt like this newfound freedom I'm walking into. My life isn't consumed with this goal of soccer that's all-encompassing. I've got more balance in my life, and I've got all these great variables in place. And then I'm in the garden, batching it in the Garden of Eden. And then came along Eve in the garden. And Melinda and I met here at the church. We knew each other as kids. I don't think she's in here. Anyways, we met each other as, we knew, our families knew each other as kids. She was 4 years older than me, so when I was, she told her parents, she's like, I want to have little boys just like those Pronto boys. Like she was like babysitting age, and I'm like the kid that she would babysit. So like that 4 year gap at the time was a big deal. Anyways, we got a little boy just like a little Pronto boy now. So, but anyways, we didn't know each other at all. I knew her younger brothers a bit because we were on more of a similar level, but. Anyway, so we reconnect now, I guess, as adults here at the church. It was a Christmas, it was the week before Christmas Eve service, and then we connect again on Christmas Eve. Anyway, she was in Haiti. She was doing mission work. She's a midwife. She was older than me. She had all this worldly experience. All I knew was soccer. Like, you know, she felt like out of my league in that way. She's saying, I'm going to go back to Haiti. And, you know, we hadn't talked about anything. We were just connecting, and there's sort of a little bit of a spark going on there. And so she goes back to Haiti. And we never talked during, like, it was just like, oh, we kind of connected, she's gone now. But she came back 3 months later, and I guess, you know, she was kind of thinking maybe there was something there. And so she came back, long story short, I told her we dated, her youngest brother, David, I told him, because I had asked her brothers, and then finally her dad, and if you know anything about their family, you might understand why I saved her dad for, like, you know, last. And, like, I was putting that off as long as possible. But I told her brother, David, I said, you know, and this was so cheesy at the time, but I really meant it. I'm like, I think God's just given me my Eve. I said that. I said, like I feel like Adam in the garden, and I just feel like I've just been blessed with Eve. And what a blessing. Yeah, I just felt so blessed by Melinda. Her dad, he was just like, oh yeah, right on, you know, you sound like a good guy. Her dad, I got there at 9 o'clock at night. I texted him early in the day, you know, saying I have a question for him. He didn't respond. He responded at 9 o'clock at night. He's like, hey, is it past your bedtime? I said, no. He's like, why don't you come on up here? Okay. So I go up there. He rambled off of me, and I don't know if he's listening right now, but for 3 hours. We covered every topic under the sun about everything, like from appropriate to inappropriate. But nothing to do with Melinda and I. Like, just he just going to go, and then he, you know, and he's like, oh, yeah, you know, you have something to say to me or whatever. He looks at his text, you know, he said he had a question for me here. And then he's like, oh, my battery's about to die on my phone. Hold on, you gotta plug that in. Okay, we'll wait another half an hour while that charges. Okay, my phone's charged half an hour later. How do I put record on this thing, Chris? I want a video record. Okay, there we go. You know, across the table from me. Okay, Chris, you are on camera now, right? You know, you said you got a question for me. Susan, this is my mother-in-law. Come sit down. Chris has a question for us, right? Anyways, he still did, like, it still took 20 minutes for him to let me give my question. He just had this big prologue. Anyway, so I survived that whole thing. But I'll give you the last part of this. He said, the end of this was, Chris, you know, I was thinking about what you might ask, and I thought that maybe you were going to ask something along those lines, right? you know, I was thinking to myself, well, I'd like to have something funny or witty to say or something. Yeah, I'd like to have some kind of smart comment for you. He's like, I couldn't think of anything. All I can think of is a question that I got for you. Give me one good reason why I should say yes. He's like, not three reasons. You know, I don't need like one good reason why I should say yes. Now, I don't know if you know what it's like to be tired and to have not had gotten a word in edgewise for 3 hours, you know, for a period of time, where your brain's only turning, but your mouth's not moving anymore, right? Like, you like to be able to articulate now, to jump into, like, thinking under pressure. So now I'm having to come up, like, I wasn't ready for that. So now I'm coming with this on the spot. I got to come up with the right answer. And again, by God's grace, I think, I don't know if he just inspired me, but I said, I'm thinking of the answer as my mouth is mouthing the words, right? And I was like, because in my head, like, because I love her. No, that's definitely not the right answer. He's not going to go for that, right? Because, still thinking, when my love isn't enough, God's will be. That's my answer. Don't know where that came from or how I came up with that. But essentially what I was trying to say is that when I'm not good enough for your daughter, I'm going to rely on God to be good enough for your daughter. And he looked at me, and he didn't say anything right away. He let me kind of stew enough. He's like, Chris, bingo, bango, bongo. That's the right answer. So he said, yes, there you go. I had up here, but this, I don't know where we're at for time. Am I anywhere? Because I did. Okay. You guys just cut me off whenever. Hopefully we'll get to the part where I actually had my message. But, okay. But the serpent still prowls. I want to say this. Just before I asked Melinda to marry me, I had asked God. I was at Lyle's Bible study, and I'm feeling like more open to, or more in touch with the spiritual side now. I think, you know, I've been exposed to this, and I'm thinking, okay, I can talk to God more now, and maybe he might answer me more. And I don't think that's one of my giftings, like the gift of prophecy or the gift of words of knowledge. It's not something, I've had it happen on a rare occasion, but it's not something that I operate in. But I was trying to, nothing wrong with that. And I'm asking God, you know, am I supposed to marry Melinda? And this is this perfectionism thing, like creeping back in. And this, if any of you deal with perfectionism or this A-type personality, it's very easy to go from a relationship with God into a religious, legalistic thing with God, where you're all of a sudden asking him for every move, and you go from sonship into servanthood, you know, into being like a volunteer slave, and because you're trying to do the right thing, right? And I really believe that God has put us in the Garden of Eden with a free will. Like, he's given us the tool to, like, go and enjoy the life I've given you, and I'm going to be there and guiding you, but you do not need to hold my hand every step of the way and ask me every question. Your decisions need to be in line with my truth, and I'm going to go with you. But anyways, I asked God, should I marry Melinda? And I heard, no. And I'm like, wait a second, no? What? Like, I'm just like, I'm really... Now, part of this whole exercise is of experiencing or being exposed to the spiritual side of God is discernment. You know, like, we have our own busy minds. We have the enemy trying to say things to us. We have all sorts of things going on. No? What? No? And I'm freaking out. And I, out of obedience to God, I need to tell Melinda. I'm like, I was just praying about this, and I think God told me no. And Melinda, being 4 years older than me, wiser, she was freaking out a little bit on the inside. She told me that later, but she's like, you know, I don't think that was God. What, you know, what confidence and discernment be able to tell me that? Like, no, I don't think that was God. Oh, you don't? Really? Yeah, she's like, I'd pray about that a little bit more. So I start praying about it a little more, and I'm just getting nothing. Like, there's just, oh, am I supposed to marry? Nothing, 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 nothing. Okay, this whole, like, coming into manhood piece, I felt like this was a lesson in life. I just basically one night said, after a week of getting nothing, I'm like, you know what? Wait, screw it. I'm going for it. I'm going for it. I can't see a reason biblically why I shouldn't go for it. I'm going for it. And as soon as I made that decision, it was like God saying, you made your decision, I will come alongside you now, and I will bless that decision. And it was like, just like, my heart just felt it, like, boom, yes, I'm in support. And that was a huge turning point for me in terms of how I relate to God after that, because that perfectionism, the lens, the filter that I have, like, I just, I'm afraid to do things without his approval. And now, I feel like I've been free to that. It's like, God, I'm going to keep going, and I know you're going to catch me when I make a bad decision. You're going to turn me, you're going to steer the ship a different direction. Anyways, so I said the serpent's still prowls. Like, the enemy is still, he's that perfectionism, that thorn in my side. It was still working in different areas of my life. Anyways, chapter 8. The Valley of the Shadow of Death. Marriage. We go from dating, honeymoon, like, just can't wait to get married, you know, like. And then our first year of marriage. Not what I anticipated. Not only so, but we also glory in our sufferings, apparently. Because we know that suffering produces perseverance. Perseverance, character, and character, hope. Okay. 11. What time am I supposed to be done? I never paid attention. Okay, you guys are still with me? Because this is where this is actually the point of my message, as we're getting into it. Okay. Our first year marriage was, for me, really hard. I had all these expectations of what marriage was going to be like. I was operating in codependence. Like, I needed relational, like, validation, closeness. Like, I didn't have a security about myself, this perfectionism piece again. I needed all that approval, that validation. And Melinda comes from a family where it's the opposite. We're totally all, we know who we are, and we'll tell you exactly what we think of you, and don't let it bother you. So why are you taking that personally? You know, like, our family's the opposite. We beat around the bush. Maybe one day we'd be like, you know, that thing you said 3 weeks ago kind of hurt my feelings, right? Like, it's just, I was different cat than my wife. And I'm struggling because I'm just feeling, and I would do that thing where, like, I have hurt feelings and I shy away. I'm not saying anything, like, silence treatment. And her family's like, you got a problem? You let them know right now, however blunt it is, you get over it and then you move on, right? So when she would do that with me, she had a problem, boom, it would shut me down. I have hurt feelings and now I can't say anything. And when I would have hurt feelings, I'm just shying away and she's like, what's his problem? You know, she doesn't even know what's going on. We had a really challenging first year. And, but that is the best thing that has happened to me yet, is that tough year. We had two groups really help us through this. And this is, I call this my spiritual teenagehood to manhood. It felt like that thorn in my side was holding me in teenagehood. It was holding me in this level of maturity in my faith walk that I couldn't move beyond. And marriage, like, totally exposed that. And the first thing that we did is Abby Napora. Is her last name Napora still? I don't know. Anyways, Tamara's like our new Abby, like, in my mind. She's like the Abby of the church. Abby at the time before Tamara, you know, like, counselor, really convicted speaker, like, just full of wisdom. She did our premarital counseling, so she was the first phone call. We're struggling. We're really struggling. And there's this verse. Paul says this: do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. Abby was in the business of your mind getting rewired, because you can operate in a lie and it can be so ingrained in you even from birth that you can be changed by your own renewing of your mind, by understanding what the truth is, what Jesus has said, what God has said, and it can change you. And she said, your wife loves you. There's no doubt about it. She loves you. When you think that she said this thing, it hurt your feelings, that she doesn't love you, that she's not, like, that is not true. The truth is, she loves you, she supports you. She might not know how to show it yet. She doesn't, you know, you're still learning each other. But I would go into this narrative. My wife does not love me. She is not for me. She is, and when you go, especially if you're my type that goes, that goes away, that goes into the silence, your own brain, when you get into that narrative, it just, you cycle down and down. And all of a sudden, these lies, they become your truth, because you just keep repeating them to yourself. And you need to do the opposite. You need to have this truth repeated to yourself. And she said that. She's like, put elastic band on your wrist. Every time you feel that hurt feeling coming on where you're about to flee, you snap that elastic band, you tell yourself the truth. My wife loves me. She just doesn't know yet how to show me that, and I don't know yet how to receive that. Snap. So I did that for a bit, and eventually the elastic band kind of lost its, you know, like, but I just kept doing that thing, though. Like, okay, I feel hurt feelings. Okay, what's the truth? What's the truth? And you're just like holding on for dear life. What's the truth? Because you feel yourself just crumbling. And I remember the first time I won that fight inside, internally. Because I did that a few times, and I'm still in bed. And I would get really into like depression type state. It was significant. It was ridiculous, but it was my reality at the time because I was operating in that truth. I remember the first time I won that battle, where it's like you snap the last bit and she loves me, and I was right at that threshold, and you feel it in within yourself of you're about to go into that point of no return depression, and it's going to take like weeks sometimes to get out. I felt, and I just did this. I just hit that line, and I believed it for the first time. No, my wife loves me, and I didn't let myself go to the depths, and I recovered. And then the next time I failed, and I failed, and failed, and then I had another one, where I recovered, and then all of a sudden my wins start outweighing my losses. And that was the beginning of this massive change in my life, because that skill set, that thing that God gives us, this thing called truth, which will set you free, and the Bible says the truth will set you free. When you know a truth, and you can tell yourself the truth, you can be renewed. You can be transformed. This is a skill, this is a gift that God's given us. But there's two things that happen to be transformed. There's one, this understanding what the truth is. There's something else. Our struggle isn't against flesh and blood. Against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. There's something else going on. Not only do we have lies that we believe, we have something out there that are enforcing those lies, that are emphasizing those lies in our life, that are helping you keep going down. They're helping push you down with those lies. And this, Lyle really was a huge help in this. We called him one day, Michael and Cara, they helped us with this, and really going into the spiritual side of this, praying into this, like what is suppressing you? And Melinda and I, we had two experiences, one which was really potent, where I was starting to go downhill again. Same thing as the same cycle, starting to get depressed, feeling hurt feelings. You know, I've been trying to tell myself the truth, losing the battle. And Melinda, and it was really easy for my wife to get hurt feelings over my, like, you know, I'm just talking about my experience. Like, imagine her. She's getting the silence treatment. It's like she keeps failing me. Like, she thinks, like, what have I done wrong? She's starting to get frustrated. She's starting to get angry. This is amazing that she responded this way. She comes to me, and she's like, I'm going to pray over you. And this is just, you know, if you don't have the... you don't do this regularly in your marriages, like this is just in any relationship where you have a problem, it feels like it's between the two of you, but really the problem is either within yourselves or it could be something spiritual that's happening, and you don't have this in your toolbox. You know what, let's tackle this together first. Like, okay, we don't feel loving towards each other right now. Okay, we're gonna pray over this, and you just bring God into the picture as your mediator, as your warrior for you. Like, it changes the game, and you can go back to them that reminding yourself the truth, and you have your work to do in that. But anyway, she came and she prayed for me, and we just both, and again, me not being the one that operates in this, like I said earlier, it's like not my natural gifting, but we both tangibly felt this evil presence after a few minutes. Like, there was kind of a bit of a spiritual warfare. Like, Melinda was really starting to get aggressive in the way she was praying, like, this, you have to leave now, you have to leave, you are attacking. And we both felt this thing come off me and leave, and it left the room, and it was like this cloud lifted. Like, you couldn't see clearly, and now I can see clearly, and I can see clearly enough to tell myself the truth and to be able to receive it. There's two elements at play. There's our own lies that we allow in, and then there's the enemy, and he comes in and he keeps pushing those buttons. And when he's not there, it's easier to tell yourself the truth. So I just want to encourage you that way. This, you know, that is our first step of battle. Is to come together and pray, and that's hard to do when you are in conflict with each other, especially in a marriage, because that's the last thing you want to do together in that moment, right? Okay, so I'm chapter 10. There's only 10 chapters in my story, so we're getting there. Chapter 10, a newfound joy and freedom in marriage and beyond. I started our marriage after it was a year and a half where it changed. It was like struggle, struggle, struggle. And then in that 6 months, so after a year, then did the elastic band thing, starting to pray more. And it was a 6 month transition from bondage into freedom in our marriage. And And we got there, and all of a sudden became more my nature, and it became hardwired in me that I just understood now when my wife said something that would have before hurt my feelings, just doesn't now. And just because I continued to tell myself the truth, and it became my truth and became what I walked in. But this taught me something for a lot of other areas of my life. And remember this perfectionism piece. I hadn't tackled that yet. That was a lie that I was operating in that I didn't understand yet. And I just want to read this. So from God's gift of joy. So I had experienced God's gift of joy when I broke my leg. That was just a supernatural joy. Boom, I got hit with joy. It was inexplicable. But we get this joy, this freedom through these two things. And it's these two things here. We have this joy in God through Jesus, and it comes from knowing him and knowing about him. Okay, knowing him, being in relationship with God, that joy, it comes from him, like it happened to me with my leg. But when you are constantly walking with God, that joy is, it dwells up from inside you. But the other thing is, we get to empower that joy, facilitate that joy, when we know about our God. Because when we know about him, what do you know? You know he's the truth, the way, and the life. You know his truth, his promises, what he declares over your life. And we can then repeat those truths to ourselves. And we can hardwire them into ourselves. And it frees us. And I just this journey in marriage, it just opened up these doors to all these other areas of my life where I started tackling them and getting freedom in all these other areas. And joy started arising in me. And from within. And I just want to give you, okay, this is not I did not go in the Bible and handpick these all. I'd like to have more, like to say I did this more intelligently. I did a Google search. I'm like, verses about joy, right? So I'm going to read some for you because the first part, joy comes from walking with God. And here's verses that all back that up. Okay, Romans 15:13. May the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, so that by the power of the Holy Spirit you may abound in hope. Galatians 5:22-23. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such things there's no law. The fruits of the Spirit, the more you walk with God, the more they grow in you, and one of them is joy. Until now you've asked nothing, John 16, until now you've asked nothing in my name, ask and you will receive, that your joy may be full. Isaiah 9:3, you've enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest. 1 Peter, though you have not seen him, you love him, and even though you do not see him now, you believe in him and are filled with an inexpressible and glorious joy, for you're receiving the end result of your faith, the salvation of your souls. Isaiah, and those the Lord has rescued will return. They will enter Zion with singing. Everlasting joy will crown their heads. Gladness and joy will overtake them, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. I have more here, but they just go on and on. You walk with God, he fills you with joy. It's not something you have, we got joy and we got happiness. And maybe you've already heard this before, but happiness is something we can pursue. You can have something happen. It's an external thing that happens. You get filled with this emotion, this sense of happiness. But you can have happiness and have internal turmoil at the same time. You can be internally just spewing and have a happy moment. Joy, you can have joy in your heart and be in a totally terrible circumstance. You can have joy and be experiencing sadness at the same time. Joy is something that it comes from God. It is part, we were created to experience joy, and it's not something that the world gives us. It's something that God gives you. Amen. And he gives it to you both divinely, in spirit, by walking with him. You just get it. It's just a byproduct of walking with him. But he also gives it to you through his truth, because his truth sets you free. And when you learn his truth, aging, a lot of people think it's a terrible process. Now, I'm not old enough to really talk on that probably, so you guys can say, this young man can shut up there about this. But I'm just sitting here thinking, the older I get, so far, this first part of my life, I've got more joy and freedom because I know more about God's truth. Well, put another 30 years on my life, hopefully, and I'm hoping that I'm going to be that much more free because I'm going to have that much more truth I've discovered about God and what he says about me and how I'm supposed to operate. Okay, so now a couple, I feel like I've rambled on for a long enough time now. I'm going to end with this because this is how I started. One second, what was my last thing? Okay, that was. Okay. Two things I want to know. It doesn't matter the order. I'll say this first. Last verse, John 8, 31, 32. So Jesus said to the Jews who had believed him, "If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." When we abide in his word, and I looked up abide, abide's got a couple of different parts to it. Abide is not just to follow his word, but it's to dwell in his word, it's to know his word, it's to act out his word. Like, it's, abide kind of carries all those actions. It's like a you are actually doing it. It's an action that you are walking out his word, walking out his truth. You're knowing it, you're putting it in, you're dwelling in it. When we do that, we will know his truth, the truth will set us free. But lastly, I want to read this to you. I quote to you a verse at the very beginning, and it was Paul, and Paul was talking about how he's learned to be content in all things. And he's learned this, and he said, "I can do all this through him who gives me strength," Jesus. Right before he says that, he says these two things, and this is the key to where his strength is coming from. He tells us in the verses prior, this is what I do. Here's my strategy. It's not a mystery. This is how I access God's strength. And this is Philippians 4, verse 4. And he says this, and I'll end on this. "Rejoice in the Lord always." I'll say it again, rejoice. "Let your gentleness be evident to all. The Lord is near." So first of all, you got to know that that's the truth. Is he far away or is he near? The Lord is near. "Don't be anxious about anything, but in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your request to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus." So, tactic number one. You're coming to God. Everything that's given you anxiety, you give it to him. And with thanksgiving. Now, how could you be thankful? You're thankful because you know his truths and his promises. You know what he's promised for you. You know he has a life for you. You know he's going to take care of you. I can give you my anxieties with thanksgiving because I know your shoulders are wide enough to take it. And I know that what I'm going to get back is your peace. And then tactic number two. "Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about these things. Whatever you've learned or received or heard from me or seen in me, put it into practice and the God of peace will be with you." While he's sitting in prison, it's super easy to decide what your thoughts are going to be. You can sit there and think about, low is me. I'm stuck here in prison. I'm waiting to get out. I don't like the people who put me in here. You know, like that, you have the freedom to choose that. I want to venture to say that Paul, while he was in prison, he did not allow himself to go into that kind of thinking. Because that kind of thinking, like me with Melinda, saying that, you know, she hurt my feelings and low is me. I'm just thinking about, you're thinking about lies. You're thinking about things that are a distraction from God's truth. I would say, while he's sitting in prison, he's thinking about all these churches he's been talking to. He's thinking, he's praying for them. He's like, he is thinking about God. He's thinking about his truth. He's thinking about his promises. He's thinking about the purpose that God's put in his life, why he's doing what he's doing, why he's in prison, what God's got for him, that God's in control, not him. You know, when we start thinking about all these truths, we are just being built up. It's very easy to start thinking about lies and start being built down. So, I'll leave you with that. Thanks for having me up again. And maybe I'll just close in prayer. I don't know if Lyle's singing again or if we've gone too long, but anyways. Thanks. Anyways, Father, thank you so much for what you've done in my life. Thank you for the joy and the freedom, that especially in these last few years that you've given me in my life. I want to impart that and pray that for everyone here. If there's any areas that people are experiencing here today that they are not free in, that there's a lie that, you know, they may be even unaware of, Father, that you would expose that lie to them, you would show them your truth that you have for them, you'd show them the freedom you have for them. Father, would you just, I pray your freedom, I pray your life, your fullness of life over this congregation, over everyone here, everyone listening. Father, thank you that you are the author and perfecter of our faith, that this life, although it can be hard at times, truly is a gift. Because you are shaping us and you are bringing us closer to you. Thank you, Father. Amen.